Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair. If you enjoy binge-watching the best TV shows and love hearing from the actors and showrunners who make them happen, then subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our Hollywood reporters take you behind the scenes of the year's most anticipated projects, the industry's biggest moves, and the hardest-fought awards races. From The Crown to The Real Housewives, we've got the inside scoop. As a special thank you to our still-watching audience, we're offering 15% off a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair. Visit vanityfair.com today and use promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15 for 15% off a yearly digital subscription to everything you want.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
AI is making waves in every field it touches. President Biden is now on TikTok, and the election draws closer each day. With so much going on in the world, it is hard to keep up with it all, let me tell you. Hi, I'm Kai Ryssdal, the co-host of Make Me Smart. It's a podcast from Marketplace. And every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I break down the latest in business and the economy with short daily episodes to make it easy for you to stay in the know. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.
Bring yourself back online.
No one knows what I'm thinking.
Tell us what you think of your world.
This is just a cheap trick.
Some people choose to see the ugliness in this world. The disarray. I choose to see the beauty.
Hello and welcome back to Still Watching Westworld. I'm Vanity Fair Senior Writer Joanna Robinson.
And I'm Vanity Fair Chief Critic Richard Lawson.
If you are just joining us for the first time, what we do on Still Watching is Richard and I pick a show that is currently airing that we are sort of obsessively watching. And we break it down week by week, talk about themes or questions we have. We tend to have a lot of questions around the TV show Westworld, so we have a lot to talk about this week. We are talking about season 3, episode 2, The Winter Line. We will not be spoiling anything that comes after season 3, episode 2, The Winter Line. Richard, on a scale of 1 to 10, how excited were you to find out that this was a Maeve episode?
I mean, very excited. I feel like when Maeve is back, we're back to Westworld as we know it. You know, the premiere episode had to establish the new stakes and the new realities of season 3. I understand that. It wasn't my favorite episode of the show because it just didn't feel like the show. And now this episode, which is largely set in Westworld or a version of Westworld, as we find out, I felt like we were back with our old friends and the old rhythms. And I really appreciated that.
Love it. Yeah, it's interesting because this is a very, sort of plot-wise fairly straightforward in terms of we are only really following two main characters. We've got the Maeve stuff and the Bernard stuff. And they interact very briefly, sort of in an abstract way, but, these are our two plot lines. We have none of the, like, major mainland stuff. So, that's what we will be talking about this week. But before we get into episode 2 discussion, I just wanted to go through a few emails that we got from listeners about episode 1 of the season. You can always email us at stillwatchingpod@gmail.com. We love your questions, your comments, your corrections. All are welcome, especially as Richard and I are cooped up in our houses. There's nothing to do but read emails sometimes, it feels like. So I want to start with this idea. This comes not from one specific email, but from a few responses I've gotten about, you know, that implant that they were taking in episode 1, that sort of like digital implant, sort of take the edge off the pain thing that the we saw a couple times in episode one. Someone pointed out, or a couple people actually pointed out, that the implant itself, though it has like a little chip in the middle, kind of looks like a communion wafer in that it is like wafer shaped, and the way in which it's sort of, is, especially as it's given to Caleb's mom in the hospital, almost looks like taking communion. And so this idea of like gods and worshiping technology and like communing with technology and stuff like that is something that's sort of on people's minds thematically this season. And so a listener named Christian wrote in this email. He says, in the season 3 premiere at the 52-minute mark, a goon is pointing a gun at Caleb's head. And he says, want to make it the first time getting shot in the head? And Caleb replies, someone else beat you to that too. The second the words leave his mouth, the side of Caleb's head, the exact same spot Dolores pointed to at the insight party, the nucleus accumbens, and said was responsible for religious belief, becomes brilliantly illuminated. It's a very weird blink and you'll miss it moment, but it doesn't seem to be a coincidence. What do you make of it? Will Dolores become the god or higher power that Caleb comes to believe in? Love the show. Keep up the great work. Christian. I missed it. Maybe I was blinking. I haven't gone back to check to see what Christian's talking about here. It is something that Westworld might do, so I'm not saying it didn't happen. But I do think this idea of like Caleb as a lost soul and Dolores as like something that he can latch onto is pretty convincing to me. And whether or not that takes on sort of like a religious worshipfulness, we'll see. Do you have any thoughts about that, Richard?
Well, I mean, they have been referred to as gods before. I mean, right. If I remember correctly, and like in the premiere episode, you know, Dolores says like the real gods are here and they're, you know, angry or whatever she says, you know? So clearly this is like, this season is like pointing us somewhere in that direction. And I think the interesting thing that episode 2 sets up with, you know, at the very end of the episode, like Maeve receives some sort of, you know, mission, that she's not accepted yet, but I assume will. You have almost then warring deities. And so is this kind of like the war in heaven kind of, you know, happening on the human, you know, plane and what that means for everybody. And, I don't know. I think that's an interesting setup. It brings to mind a little bit like Jacob, Man in Black, Losty stuff a little bit, you know, this kind of duality that had to do with sort of supernaturally kind of overseer people. I don't think that anything on this meticulously rendered show is an accident. So I appreciate the listener kind of pointing that out in their letter.
Yeah, it's interesting to me because this idea, I didn't notice until I went through the first season and episode 1 in the obsessive way I do sometimes when I create the posts that live on VF.com, where I make these like comparison GIFs where I take something from an earlier episode and I smash it together with something from a current episode. It helps me see connections that I missed before. And like I had forgotten to put together the idea that when like Dolores stumbles out of that tunnel into Caleb's arms at the end of episode 1, that's the exact same way that she met William in the park in season 1, right? She stumbles out of the tree line into his arms. It's like almost an exact sort of shot for shot recreation of that. And I think we did mention last week that like Caleb says he's looking for something real. He needs to find someone real. And right after that, obviously Dolores stumbles out into his arms and William was looking for the same thing. So this idea of like the pursuit of the real, I don't think they're going to retell that story. So Caleb, I think, has to react differently to the revelation of who Dolores is than William does in order for Westworld to not be completely repeating itself. And then, you know, and what you're mentioning in terms of the war in heaven, between Maeve and, Dolores, that's sort of like, you're thinking like the Archangel Michael, is it like Lucifer in the fall? Like, is Dolores Lucifer? Is Maeve, you know, the Judeo-Christian God that we've come to believe? Like, how would you cast those roles in these powerful beings?
Well, I don't even know if it's something, I mean, I guess maybe the analogy wasn't completely apt because you know, there is a presiding God in terms of like the people who created this technology. And maybe God is this new thing we're learning about, the big kind of glowing orb thing that seems to be able to predict the future. You know, so I don't really know, but I think, or it could just be, two very powerful entities vying for a position that doesn't exist yet, you know? And I think the interesting thing about the character dynamic, between Dolores and Maeve is that sometimes Dolores as a character, I think she's compelling, and I think that Evan Rachel Wood is great in the role. But like, she's so kind of monomaniacal that like, you know, she's kind of on the set course that feels very deterministic. Whereas Maeve is such an unknown, like she's not Lord Dolores's enemy. She's not her ally. Maeve has such kind of complicated motivations. Obviously her daughter is kind of chief of mind, but now her daughter is quote unquote in a better place. So what is she just trying to join her there? What the kind of ultimate plan will be for Maeve, I think really interestingly offsets, this sort of mandate to rule that Dolores has, you know,
I think
that Serac at the end saying, you know, this big glowing orb or whatever detected an anomaly, something that it couldn't predict. And we thought it was you, but it's not you, but you're still right. You know, so I think that like all of this kind of power dynamic is at a very interestingly precarious spot. Now that Dolores has, I guess there's, you know, Bernard too, but like really Maeve in an interesting counterbalance.
Yeah. And maybe what if it is Bernard? You know what I mean? Like we're assuming like Serac assumes since it's not Maeve that it's Dolores, and Dolores and Maeve assumes that too. But Bernard is still a player on this table. And like Bernard tends to switch allegiances over courses of seasons. So, you know, we'll see what he decides down the road.
Yeah. Or unknown variable, Joanna, could be love.
Oh my gosh. This is a Jonathan Nolan joint.
Yeah, exactly.
We should remember Interstellar. Okay. The last email that I'm going to read before we'll sort of dive into this episode directly is in response to something we were talking about last week, Richard, when you raised the idea that, certainly not everyone on the mainland can escape to Westworld, you know, if they want to, because it's very costly. And, I'm going to read, the person did not sign their email this way, but it's how their name is displayed on their email. And I just want to give them the full honorific. So Dr. Robert Handy, which I think is a great name, wrote in during the early episodes, it was mentioned the cost for one day at Westworld or Dulles Destinations was $40,000 in today's dollars. So $40,000 a day, to go to Westworld. So, you know, just in case you were planning to save up for a trip, that's how much it would cost you. All right. So this episode's called The Winter Line, which is a reference to World War II, you know, fronts fought in Italy. So very apt title relating to Maeve's trips to this simulation of War World. Richard, you said you had some questions around this episode. Do you want to start with your questions that you have about what happened here?
So I've seen the episode a couple times now and definitely understand it more than I did on the first go around. But so obviously Maeve realizes that she's in a simulation, you know, because obviously the hosts are in the real corporeal world, but just living in a kind of loop thing, right?
Right.
And the first season is about them breaking out of that loop.
Right.
And then the second season is about kind of figuring out what to do with that consciousness. And also we kind of learn more about the technology. So I guess what this episode is kind of, I forget if it's reminding us or establishing for the first time that this technology can put consciousness into a physical robot body and send it out into the world or the park or whatever. Or it can play that consciousness out in virtual reality. I guess that's kind of what where all the other hosts went, you know, right? They're non-corporeal now, right?
Right, right.
So they have this technology to kind of keep files kind of ever running or what simulations ever running, but they just don't have any body to them.
Right.
So I get that. I guess my question is, when Maeve has that dawning consciousness that she's in a simulation, how can, with this control panel in the simulation, can she control things in the real world, meaning the robot that takes her pearl and tries to make a run for it? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I feel like she's acting as sort of like a, almost a virus in the system. Like, since her consciousness, her code is in their system, she can then move around in the lines of code of their system to control other things that are controlled by their system, including that robot. Does that make sense? That's how I would interpret
it. Okay. Yeah, so she's just like, she's in the Matrix. She can do a lot of things. Okay.
And that's, I mean, so the parallel to that in season two is, you know, Anthony Hopkins' character, Robert Ford, his human self died in season one. Dolores shot him. He's dead. But he had uploaded his own consciousness to the Cradle, which is the name of, like, the place where they stored all the guests back up. And, or I think, or he was in the Forge. One of the two. He's in the lines of code of the park, is the point. And we found out that he was, like, controlling a bunch of stuff from behind the scenes from inside the code. So it's sort of like a yada, yada, yada hand wave. Like, once you're inside the code, you can kind of, and you're smart enough, like Ford is and like Maeve is, you can move around and sort of manipulate other things, you know. And Serac is enormously impressed by this, obviously. He's like, you rewrote your own code, like the code of the system in real time. That was incredible. So yeah, so it's not like a small thing that she accomplished. It's a huge thing she accomplished, but that's the thing about Maeve. Like, I feel like the only people that we know who would be able to do that we've met are like Maeve, Dolores, Bernard, and Ford, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So. All right, any other questions?
That was my big one, and that was satisfyingly answered, so thank you.
Okay, you're welcome. All right, so well, let's start. So we start, we think we're still in the park, right? And
right.
Maeve's in this park war world. And, you know, one has to hope that if a guest comes to Westworld, because I'm assuming this is based on a real park, park number four in the park. Presumably, if someone comes to this park, they want to play someone on the Allied side, but I suppose one could play a Nazi if one wanted to. Like,
I don't buy that. No one really aspires to be Nazis. Not now. Not in this few. I mean, come on. That's too fantastical to believe. There's no one in this country or anywhere who identifies with that ideology right now.
You're right. How silly of me. Okay, preposterous idea. But yeah, so we are in Italy. Maeve is there. She has this like misunderstanding. She sees Hector. He's named Ettore now. And, they have this like misunderstanding crossfire where he's in character as this like, Italian spy. And she thinks he's talking about like the humans and all this sort of stuff when he's talking about, the Nazis and all of that. So, non-human individuals. So,
right. Because poor Maeve's like whole thing is like, she's just constantly waking up somewhere and trying to have to figure out where and when she is.
Oh, right.
You know? And luckily she's like very smart now and can really figure, and always was, I guess, and can figure it out like relatively quickly. But like, as we see, you know, when she wakes up at Serac's kind of compound, she's like, okay, where am I now? You know?
What the fuck now? What am I wearing now? Yeah.
And her kind of like sad little disappointment when she realized that Hector was not Hector that she thought he was is just kind of like, she's like, oh shit, again. Like I am alone. I thought I wasn't. And then it happens again with Lee.
Yeah. And I mean, what's interesting to me is that the Hector stuff doesn't super work like perfectly for me. Cause I think some of the, like the double talk, like she's like, where are we? And he's like, in hell. And she's like, ah, yes, the hell of robotic enslavement. He's like, the hell of Nazi era, Italy or whatever. Like it's all a little like, clunky for me, but then like it lowered my expectations. And so they got me with the Lee reveal. How did that work for you?
It worked, except I was so confused because I was like, I thought all this was destroyed and a lot of you were dead. Like, I don't get it. Like,
and I
know that was intentional, but I think sometimes, you know, that felt a little bit like, you know, the complaints about season two where there was just too obfuscating. These timelines were too hard to parse. And actually, it was too hard to even realize that there were different timelines. You know what I mean? Yes. And so this is them trying to simplify things, but also kind of having like a sort of temporal mystery. but like wanting to solve it by the end of the hour. And it felt a little bit like kind of like a gimmick for no reason, but I mean, I get, but you know, it was nice to see Lee again and to also in that way, like have Maeve really say goodbye to the real Lee.
Yeah.
And I love when she was like, he died a good man, and all this stuff that they thought he was, like that he was obsessed with me and all this, just was not true. And
yeah, she's like, you don't get it. You don't get it all who he was. Yeah,
so if this is the end for that actor whose name I forget,
Simon Quarterman.
Yeah, like it was a nice little send off, I thought.
I also felt like she gave a really sincere goodbye to the Hector character. So I would not be surprised if Rodrigo Santoro and Simon Quartermain don't come back at all in Westworld. I mean, they're guest stars this season. So
do you think that all the cast members like Santoro and Marsden and Quartermain are like, wait, but why does Luke Hemsworth get to keep going?
Why can't I be a secret robot that shoots myself in the head and I'm still here?
Ben Barnes maybe threw something at the TV.
I mean, I kind of got the sense that Marsden wanted out. I don't know. Like, that's completely, I have no evidence for that.
Well, he had to do Sonic.
But I kind of feel like, and I wouldn't blame him because Marsden was kind of, when the show started, Marsden was kind of, I assumed that he would be like the third or fourth lead, and it's not like I mind that Evan Rachel Wood and Tandy Newton are leads above him, because like you know good looking guys like James Marsden get plenty of HBO shows starring them, but like but there's a lot of people that I think would be counted as leads above Marsden, and then they also with Teddy like never really figured out anything like tremendously interesting to do with him until his death.
Right.
And so we talked about this last season that we felt like it was just sort of a waste of Marsden, who is a great, great, great actor. And I really like him. And so, like either the writers were like, we don't know what to do with Teddy, or Marsden was like, I want out. But that's how his end last season felt to me, was like,
yeah.
We can't do anything with this character. He's done. And then go ahead.
Yeah, I think the minute that the writers, maybe Lisa Joy and Jonathan Nolan, whoever, like figured out, however early on, that this was a show about like kind of an allegorical thing about women, kind of, you know, fighting off their oppression.
Yeah.
The Marsden character kind of lost a lot of like use. Which I think is fine, because like you said, like an actor like James Marsden is going to be fine. And right. We didn't necessarily need like a Teddy hero in this show.
Right.
But yeah, I think it's just an interesting thing where like it's rare that a show has shed so many principal cast members by season three.
Yeah. And I mean, like my conspiracy theory at the end of last season was that a lot of that was budgetary.
Right.
Because, you know, the ratings for Westworld were like, okay in season two, not anywhere near season one level. And then they had like a pretty actually dramatic drop off this year. It's a -57%, I believe, is the viewership between season two and season three. And I think that, you know, Westworld was famously like an enormously expensive show for HBO. And we've talked about how the idea of them filming like in Singapore and in Los Angeles, which they did for a lot of the like real world locations this year, is a lot cheaper than filming out, you know, in the Mesa, area. But also just shedding cast members left and right is a big part of that. Cause they added people, but it's like really only just like Aaron Paul and Vincent Cassell that are like, I think, main cast members this season new, and they got rid of so many, like Shannon Woodward and like you know, like the actress who played Clementine and the actress who played Angela, and the, you know, like they just like they were dropping like flies at the end of last season. And so I just think that that's like a case of them wanting to streamline their cast budgetarily, but I have no actual evidence for that, so maybe it's just all storytelling. All right. Sorry. That was a tangent. but, you know, if Lee Sizemore and Hector are never coming back, I'm glad those characters got very sincere and, lengthy send-offs, because Lee Sizemore especially, like, I was actually extremely excited to see him back. And I loved his interaction, even though it's, like, not the real Lee Sizemore, I loved his interactions with Maeve in this episode. And it made me realize retroactively how much I love the evolution of his character in season two. So I was really glad for all of that.
Yeah, and I like any show that's about a lot of good-looking men sacrificing themselves to help Tandy Newton along in her journey.
As it should be. So say we all.
The Run Through with Vogue is where you'll meet all the most exciting people in fashion and culture.
I am Fran Lebowitz, who should be the mayor of New York.
We all support that. We support that.
Very nice.
Nikki.
Yes.
It's been really great being in this beautiful pink room.
All right, Usher, can you hear us?
I can hear you.
All right.
Can you hear me?
We can.
We can.
All right, here we are.
On the podcast, you'll learn how Vogue really works.
Sometimes we'll come in for a second or even third run through until we are AWOC.
Can you tell us what AWOC means?
It means AWOK, Anna Wintour OK.
I'm Cho Minardi.
And I'm Chloe Mel.
And we're the hosts of The Run Through with Vogue, where fashion and culture collide.
Join us. It's AWOC.
Listen and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
This message comes from Apple Card. Earn up to 3% daily cash back on every purchase every day. Then grow it at 4.50% annual percentage yield when you open a savings account with Apple Card. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card subject to credit approval. Savings available to Apple Card owners subject to eligibility. Savings accounts provided by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, member FDIC. Terms apply.
All right, so speaking of handsome men elsewhere in Westworld, Luke Hemsworth and Jeffrey Wright, a.k.a. Stubbs and Bernard, are finding each other again and figuring out what's going on with Maeve and in the real Westworld, because Maeve's in a simulation. And yeah, it's a little tricksy for a while because you think they're on a collision course because, you know, they're both running around the Mesa, but it turns out she's in a fake Mesa. And as you say, like, yes, that's them having their cake and eat it too in terms of like making it temporally complicated, but also resolving it before the episode's over. But the fact that they resolved it before the episode was over made me not irritated with it, if that makes sense. Like, I would have been really irritated if we were in War World all season or something like that. And then it was like, just kidding. Which is why when people like speculate that the Dolores in the real world stuff is its own simulation, like a lot of people think that, like, oh, it's future world and Dolores is actually, I'm like, that if they pull that again, I will be extremely irritated. So
That would be a pain. I hope that I don't think that's true.
I hope it's not true. You never know with Westworld, but I hope it's not.
Something that was confusing to me about the Stubbs and Bernard, which is a great name for like a 1984 action movie that's like a ripoff of Lethal Weapon or something, is so there are obviously still Delos employees, security people, like kind of managing the park, because Stubbs has a kind of, you know, he fights them off with an axe.
Right.
So I understand that, but why would there also be like medieval from another world, I guess we haven't seen, hosts still in costume kind of on their little loops in those glass cages? Like, was that just kind of a stylistic thing, or is there some reason to think that like we're going to see that more of that at some point?
I don't know. So there's 6 parks in the Delos Destination galaxy. and we've seen 5 of them. So there's, if you count this medieval world stuff, that's 5 of the 6 that we've seen, which is the Raj, Shogun, Westworld, War World, and Medieval World, right? So there's a 5th mysterious park. And I think they did say we were going to see all the parks before the show was over. And so I kind of feel like they showed us Medieval World. So like, okay, now we know what that other park is, you know what I mean? Right. I don't know that we're ever gonna go to there, though I wouldn't mind going there. I Stubbs has some line about, like, which felt a little hand wavy, but he's like, oh, everyone's just still doing their jobs, hoping that they don't get laid off. So I think it's just like the techs.
Sounds familiar.
Yeah, right. So I think the techs are just, you know, running their diagnostics and writing their narratives and all that sort of stuff like that, as if the park is going to reopen for business again. Yeah, this does suddenly seem depressingly familiar. So, you know, just it, there are
getting
no
word from the authority right. about what's happening.
Right.
Chaos reigns. Yeah.
There are no active guests in the park. The park is shut down in that regard.
They keep calling him Chinese Bernard. It's like a whole Wuhan Bernard.
Wuhan Bernard. Oh no. All right. But speaking of medieval worlds, we should probably talk about the cameo in this episode. Do you have any thoughts or feelings about the Game of Thrones cameo in this episode?
So I know they were in it, but were they in the medieval garb? Was that them? No.
No, they were the techs. So Weiss and Benioff, who created Game of Thrones, were these like two techs, as like Stubbs and Bernard are walking around. They're these two techs who are working on a dragon, and the dragon is Drogon from Game of Thrones. Mm. And one of the techs, played by Dan Weiss, says like, there's a buyer who's interested off the coast, you know, in a startup in an island off the coast of Costa Rica or something like that, which is a Jurassic Park reference, by the way. And so they're like, and then the one played by David Benioff is like, how are we going to get this, something this big over there? And then the one played by Dan Weiss is like, goes with a buzzsaw towards Drogon. Like they're going to cut up Drogon, the dragon from Game of Thrones, and send him to Jurassic Park, I guess is the whole joke. That was not my favorite part of the episode, to put it mildly.
I have to be honest, I've watched the episode twice and I have missed that both times. Like that entire exchange has been like,
it's
blacked
very background.
Out
it's very background.
Okay.
It's not like it's happening as sort of, Bernard and Stubbs are walking past. And so like what's possible or probable is that for most people, it might just like fly over their heads because they like aren't watching the show as obsessively as I am. For me, I'll just say, you know, since you don't recall seeing it, I will just say that the Weiss and Benioff of it all doesn't really bother me that much. Like that's fine. Give them, cute. They work in medieval worlds, and that's funny because Game of Thrones is sort of medieval worlds, so like that's kind of funny. But like the fact that Drogon's there, I'm like, but why? why did you put your dragon in this other show? I don't know. It just doesn't. It seems like it left a really sour taste in my mouth, so I wasn't a fan of it. All right. Does everything that's happening with Stubbs make sense to you, Richard? Like in terms of why, what he was doing in the park and why he's going with Bernard now?
Yeah. I mean, I think that, you know, he's basically getting like he's helping us realize what his arc this season's going to be. It's getting the info. It's chasing, Dolores around the world or wherever, trying to get her, you know, sometimes getting there ahead of her, maybe sometimes just missing her, you know, it's cat and mouse kind of thing, which right. I think is like a fine setup for a season of television, but would feel maybe a little bit, you know, kind of predictable or staid had there not been the Maeve factor kind of complicating things, because again, her mandate is a little bit more murky. I think like, I like that these three have kind of been reduced to like being the kind of core triumvirate of the show. Further kind of making me wonder what Aaron Paul's character is going to be all about as we continue. But, yeah, you know, I like that. And I think, you know, Stubbs is kind of a sidekick. That's cute. And also it brings to, you know, it brings another host out into the real world.
Yeah.
You know, which is an interesting variable to have in play in some way or another.
Yeah, there's something about Luke Hemsworth and this role. I just like love him, and I love Stubbs, and I'm really glad that they made him a host so that he can still be on the show. Because like I'm a big fan of him, and I like the way that he's very like the sarcastic way in which he interacts with Bernard. What do you make though of Bernard reprogramming him? Like, to me, it felt a little invasive. Like, and Stubbs makes it a joke where he's just like, oh, you could just, if you wanted me to go with you, you could have just asked. But like, Bernard's like, okay, your new core drive is to protect me at all costs. Like, you know, does that jive with like the Bernard we've known? Is that like more of an Arnold move? Like, what does that seem like to you?
Yeah, I mean, it felt a bit like maybe less like trying to see a human side of a host, you know? I mean, I guess Bernard is one too. Yeah, it felt a little bit like Westworld version of Problematic, you know? Like,
yeah.
Like, let me have my free will, you know? But I think he kind of also knew that Stubbs wouldn't do it on his own. So, you know, and maybe that dynamic will keep changing. Who knows?
Yeah, that would be interesting to see because, like, you know, he's basically done to Stubbs sort of what Ford did to him. And we should remember that this character that Jeffrey Wright is playing this season is not just Bernard. He's also Arnold. And the way we know that for sure, is that when he like sort of hooks himself in, he like hooks himself into the system when they're in the sort of in the Mesa labs. And he has these flashes of memory, and they're not just Bernard's memories, because he like remembers Dolores being in the forge, reading John Gallagher Jr.'s book, you know, like blah, 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 all of that. But he also has Arnold memories too. And so he's a little bit Bernard, a little bit Arnold, you know, a little bit Alexis. Like that's who, Jeffrey Wright is playing this season. And so if he does stuff that maybe we would think Bernard wouldn't do, that is perhaps his Arnold coming through. And we should remember that Arnold like programmed Dolores to kill all of the hosts in the park and then kill him, way back before, Westworld opened. So, you know, this guy, you know, Arnold is like a kindly father figure, but he's also like, he also, you know, did some serious damage to his own creations in that way. So there you go. All right. And then let's hit this last major interaction, which is like, you know, Maeve does her best to escape from this lab. This lab, we don't know exactly where it is, but, the warning signs, the warning stuff over the loudspeaker is half in French. So, you know, maybe she's in France. Maybe she's in some like, tropical island that speaks French. I don't know because
maybe she's in Montreal.
Oh, Montreal. Are there palm trees in Montreal?
Yeah, sure.
but so she is in, the, you know, the headquarters of wherever the, like, the Insight Corporation, Rehoboam, like, shadowy, whatever, headquarters are because, the character of Serac, who we heard about last week, who is the guy with the access to the system and the guy who maybe killed Liam Dempsey's father and the guy who is like actually quite scary, is dressed all in beautiful, impeccable whites and played by, Vincent Cassell. And here he is, enlisting Maeve's help. What did you think of this character introduction?
I think it's an interesting one. I think that, like, he adds a certain kind of feisty kind of Euro flair to it. I think he and Tandy Newton are well matched. I think pretty much Vincent Cassell just gets a phone call and strides onto set in a beautiful, crisp, you know, tailored suit, looking like he was just, you know, on a yacht in the French Riviera. Like, he's just kind of got that aura about him when he wants to.
Yeah.
And I think that that's a fun dynamic to add to this show, you know. I think, you know, I mentioned this last week, but, you know, he kind of, Serac, kind of lays out what the sort of central hive mind of this season is with this big glowing orb. And it really, about, you know, looking into the future and kind of having everything be on this deterministic path. And it really made me think a lot about Devs, which, you know, I mentioned last week,
yeah,
which is a show on Hulu, which is kind of about almost exactly the same thing. And, you know, no knock necessarily Nick Offerman, who plays the kind of like central leader or creator of that technology on Devs. I think that Vincent Cassell in this kind of like leisure, you know, wealthy, Frenchman mode is a bit more of an interesting, you know, guide through this sort of technological idea, I guess. So I appreciated the energy he brought to basically expositional dialogue. And, 'cause, you know, it's kind of confusing things, but I think my understanding, and correct me if I'm wrong, is this visual motif that we've been seeing with this kind of glowing circle or a black circle, kind of almost like this stuff in Arrival, that says, you know, like, I forget what the term is.
Divergence.
Yeah. That's something that's coming from this big machine, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
So it'll be interesting to see, like, if Serac as a character is just going to be kind of like popping in and out to kind of, you know, issue new orders or whatever, or if he's really going to be sucked into the main sort of thrust of the season.
I don't mind turning this briefly into like a Devs and Westworld like co-podcast right now, because what I think is interesting, and I don't think you need to have seen Devs to know this, I'll just give you some like basic background, which is this, that like Devs is set in the near future in the San Francisco Bay Area. They filmed in San Francisco and down in Santa Cruz. And Nick Offerman like plays the founder of this tech company that has you know the potential, let's say, to have a huge impact on the way in which we lead our lives. And something, you know, I got a chance to talk to Alex Garland when he was out here filming it, and something he was talking about were these like titans of Silicon Valley, many of whom like walk around in like hoodies and Adidas slides or whatever, if you want to use the Social Network version of them. Like, they're these usually men, sometimes women, but usually men, who have enormous power over the way in which we live our lives, but are not elected or held in any kind of check at all whatsoever. You know what I mean? Like, they're not the president. We can't impeach them. They just have a ton of money. And more than any other, you know, I guess you could say like, you know, CEOs, same as it ever was in terms of like major powerful CEOs. But I think there's a difference between the way in which like, I don't know, a steel baron would control our lives back in the day versus like the person who puts the machine in your pocket at all time, the person who has like a camera on you at all times, who tracks your movements at all times, like the way in which digital, products have invaded our lives, you know, like, and I'm guilty of this as anyone, you know, like, have invaded and control and influence both subtly and unsubtly our lives, gives these men tremendous power. And the fact that often in Silicon Valley, they come in the form of these like, you know, not necessarily exactly Nick Offerman, but like these very like unassuming seeming like, I'm just a guy with a hoodie, like whatever, I'm chill, I do yoga, like whatever. So I just think it is a very different approach to have someone like Vincent Cassell, who is like, born to be a supervillain, you know, in his crisp suit, be the head of this. I don't know. There's something to me a little bit more villainous about someone who looks like Nick Offerman, especially how Nick Offerman looks in Devs, be the head of that organization versus Vincent Cassell, you know?
I think the difference between the two, and I think people really should watch Devs. It's very interesting. But the difference between the two is like, one is kind of a horror movie about someone who is kind of heedless to the rest of the world and just keeps kind of like amassing technological knowledge and, you know, ability because, you know, they're sort of on this like drive, like single-minded pursuit, the way that, you know, you're sort of prototypical, nerdy kind of tech billionaire who realizes they have power, but, you know, but isn't quite sort of, doesn't really have any sort of ambitions about it beyond just kind of more knowledge or whatever. And then you have a sort of like more slickster business person who is a capitalist in the truest sense and, you know, wants to kind of manipulate things that way. And I think that's more what Cassell's character is. And I think that like, if, you know, we're setting this thing, you know, however many years in the future, like it stands to reasons that there would of course be the total, you know, the kind of nerdy, you know, tech guys or people, but also that, you know, this kind of slick-minded business stuff would also come into it and sort of co-opt it. and apply their version of sociopathy to it, you know? And I think that's you know, it's an interesting, maybe we'll meet some of the sort of more Zuckerberg-y people on this show. I don't know, maybe, but I don't know if this show is really aesthetically interested in that in the same way. But I think both shows, present a very credible and equally chilling portrait of, like you said, massively powerful entities that are in the hands of private citizens.
Right. Yeah, and we know that figures like Elon Musk are of interest to Lisa Joy and Jonathan Nolan.
Yeah.
So, you know, they have their, you know, that's, these are the people that they've had their eye on ever since the beginning in terms of like when you're talking about a Ford or, you know, an Arnold. But I think it was easier for us to separate that from our reality when we're thinking about like, oh, these men creating these life like robots. We're like, okay, that's one thing. But Visa Cassell has an algorithm that determines what, you know, like it just, that seems much more closer, you know, much closer to where we are right now. I don't know if that's, you know.
Yeah. Well, I think the interesting thing about what Westworld has done in its gradual pulling back, you know, it's gradually zooming out and out now, because it starts with like, and this again, similar to Devs in some ways, it starts with a, what if we could do this? What if we could have incredibly realistic robots who had some kind of consciousness, but also not? And then, you know, season two kind of takes a further step back and it's like, okay, in a world where that technology exists, there's no way that it would just be discreetly used for that purpose. And there's no way that something as intricate and expensive and, you know, sort of, totalizing as this park would only be used for, as a pleasure palace, essentially. And then this season now, in the two episodes we've seen, or two episodes we're talking about anyway, is taking another step back and saying like, okay, so like, here's really what the implications of a weekend in an old fake Old West town where you can kill prostitutes and banditos actually is all about, you know?
Right.
And I think technology is never really about the thing, you know, at the storefront, you know, like Facebook for many people in the world is, I can message my aunt or see what my high school classmate's up to or post a photo of my dog. And that's perfectly benign. You know, and I think that that's why some casual users of something like Facebook are like, why is everyone so mad at Zuckerberg and worried about Facebook? And it's like, because that isn't, I mean, maybe that was the intent originally, but that is certainly not the intent of something like Facebook now. And it has much further reaching power that like can be harder to see from the consumer level. But like has really, you know, kind of creepy implications. And I like that Westworld has kind of slowly introduced us to that kind of scary fact about the technology that exists in our lives.
Yeah, it's really fascinating, especially because the way in which Serac talks about it in this episode and in some of the supplemental material that HBO released before the season started is that insight, you know, or let's say the way that Liam in the season premiere talked about what his dad wanted, right? So like Insight is co-founded by Liam Dempsey Sr. and Serac. And it seems like Serac killed Liam's father at some point and now has full control of the system. But at least at one point, the idea of this algorithm was invented to try to curb what felt like a chaotic world. And like, certainly from where we're sitting right now, Richard and our respective apartments, as the world feels incredibly chaotic around us, an idea of an algorithm that would, you know, like what if someone came out of Silicon Valley today with something like, I have an algorithm that has figured out exactly what we all need to do in order to completely flatten the coronavirus curve. And, you know, it involves the CDC doing this and our government doing this and private citizens doing this. And, you know, the algorithm says if we do all of this, then corona will be no more by, you know, June. We are all in such a vulnerable place right now that who's to say we wouldn't do that? I think we would really quickly cede power to that promise of stability. But then once that algorithm has that measure of control, And then we keep just ceding more and more power to it. I mean, that's the premise of where we are here. And not that, Lisa Joy and Jonathan Nolan could have predicted that we would be in the throes of this, especially chaotic time as their third season is premiering, but it is helpful to understanding how the real world could have gotten the way that it has in this, you know, speculative fiction, this future sci-fi, that they've created.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that, like, thinking about it in those terms is kind of instructive to what is happening right now with COVID-19. Like, you know, I'm looking out my window. I'm into a kind of back alley in Brooklyn, and I can hear birds and I can hear cars, and my internet's working. I'm talking to you in California, and, you know, checking my phone or whatever. Like, everything seems relatively normal, except that I've barely left my house in a week. And I think that, like, a lot of people, a lot of kids on the beaches in Florida, I don't really blame them. They're not getting the right information. But also, just to the naked eye, it's like, well, nothing really has changed, right? But then you hear something from a hospital in, you know, that's kind of overwhelmed in Seattle, or you hear about things, economic things, not just the stock market that the president is crowing about or whatever, but, like, there's stuff always happening underneath the kind of immediate surface thing that, you know, it's like a mushroom can have, like, a huge root system, but it's just a little cap, you know, up, right, you know, poking out of the dirt. Yeah. And I think that's, you know, we have to think about COVID-19 in those terms. We have to think about all the preventative measures in those terms. It's like, yes, in the immediate, it doesn't seem like anything is really happening, but, like, something big and far reaching is happening kind of beyond what we can see. And I think that, like, that's what Westworld is, partly the technology of Westworld is about. It's like, it's not just the one fantasy week. It's all of this other stuff. And I like that the show is kind of expanding its kind of philosophical and technological inquiry, you know, because this show really is a show about free will. And like you said, like, if we had a predictive tool that would solve an immediate problem, but meant that we had to give that predictive tool a lot of, you know, credo, what would that mean if we used it once? Then are we using it for the rest of our lives? You know,
right?
I don't really know. So I think, you know, and obviously this show is cognizant of that in the way that in the first episode, again, that really had to establish this world that we're going to be dealing with. We hear about, you know, the merit, you know, this sort of merit system of, like, or like caste system almost of who can get what jobs and all like that. And so clearly that's a part of this, you know, this technology. So I don't know. I think it's an interesting time to be watching this show and thinking about these things. They're not perfect, you know, they don't graft onto each other perfectly, obviously, but,
right.
But they do prod at kind of some of the same questions, I guess.
Right. And the another real world parallel to think about is, you know, the last time I remember, you know, obviously there was a crash in 2008, but, like, the last time I remember is feeling like this vulnerable is 9/11. And when that happened, you know, we could not at the time, though I'm sure plenty of people did, but we could not at the time maybe know the full scope of what enacting something like the Patriot Act, what ceding powers to the Patriot Act, which was proffered as a promise of stability and security for us. Like, we need to put forth the Patriot Act in order to ensure the future of your secure existence in this country. So we see those powers, and we see that trickled down over the years. I didn't mean to turn this podcast discussion into something so much of a bummer, but it enriches, my experience watching Westworld to think of it through these terms. You think about the way in which, like, the Patriot Act trickles down through the years, and, you know, we get something like ICE, like Border Patrol, like all that sort of stuff is related to the overreach of Homeland Security, is related to all of that. And so, you know, who knows what we might see now that would still be affecting vulnerable people years and years and years from now. So it's just stuff to think about. Maybe nothing. Maybe everything will be fine. But, you know, stuff that's on our mind and certainly makes this, this algorithm, this insight, corporation, this, Vincent Cassell, who is couching the tremendous amount of control that he and his system wield over everyone, is couched in the terms of, we're doing it all to curb chaos, to save humanity and curb chaos in the world. And that's the way, you know, these things are often packaged in in offers of savior something. So is there anything less serious we want to end with before we close out today, Richard?
I don't know. I think that I'm very eager to. I hope that there's like a. I hope there's one scene in this season, and I've seen four episodes, so this hasn't happened yet, and I don't think it. If it happens at all, it won't be till the end. I just hope there's like a kind of like post-Avengers shawarma scene where like Maeve, Dolores, and Bernard just like sit down and have a drink. You know, like they put everything aside and are just like, what a thing, man, huh? Like, you know, maybe all of humanity is dead around them and they're just like, but like, I like these characters a lot. And I think that's interesting that they're coming from such different places and I like the heavy tone of the show, but like, I hope that the show also just like lets us like for a second sit with the fact that like they're fun characters and we're having fun with them.
Yeah, I would love to see them back in the Sweetwater Saloon one last time. Put
a song on the record.
Put
the player piano. Yeah, exactly.
All right. So the last question, where I will just float this before we close out. Where as I said, Richard and I have seen two more episodes, so we're not going to like necessarily speculate on this, but I just want to address it. We still don't know who any of the like pearls are that Dolores has in her thrall out here in the universe. So that's a question that's waiting for us. And then we haven't seen William yet this season. So Ed Harris, where art thou? Ed Harris, whither thou? So that's what we can look forward to on Westworld. Richard, until we return to the Sweetwater Saloon someday, where can folks find you?
They can find me at home, at my house, because that's where I'm supposed to be right now. I'm taking walks. I'm not just cooped up all day, but I'm being careful and doing more for other people than for myself. You know, I'm a very selfless person, Joanna, as you know.
I'm
forcing myself to sit at home and drink wine and watch TV. It's terrible. But anyway, and while I do that, I'm on Twitter at Rylaws. I've been writing stuff for VF.com, reviews of various streaming things that you can watch while you're also hopefully doing the same. Joanna, where will you be until next week?
Oh, I'm at home. Good. I am at home, sheltering in place, as we say in California. I did go to the grocery store briefly yesterday. It was harrowing and I don't want to do it again soon, so I just turned into like one of those people like so quickly where I was like, don't come near me, don't look at me, like that's the state of my mind right now. Anyway, I'm sheltering in place. If you want to find more of my work, you can go to vf.com. Yesterday I put up a little guide on like how you can rewatch all the Marvel movies if that's something you decide you want to do in your quarantine. Why not? Now's the time. You can watch them in a couple different orders. So I put up those options over on vf.com. You can follow me on Twitter at Joe Wrote This. We will be back next week with episode 3 of Westworld.
Everyone stay safe and healthy.
These violent delights and violent ends.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.